Today's talk again on meditation is about mindfulness. It is one of those qualities you hear a lot about in meditation, and it's an important quality. It's something which just grows quite naturally as you live a simple life. And coming on this retreat, because there's very little work you have to do, there's no decisions you have to make, there's very little you have to worry about, you'll notice quite naturally the mindfulness will increase. And as it increases, it makes it much easier to do things like watching, say, the full awareness of the breath, or being able to watch your sensations in the feet as you're doing walking meditation. Literally, you can see more, you're more awake, you're more alert, you are more mindful. But there are other things which you can do to increase that mindfulness. And obviously, the stronger that mindfulness becomes, the easier it is to meditate and the deeper you go, quite naturally, because you can see much more, you don't tend to stumble over the obstacles of meditation. You literally can see what you're doing, and you can see what the problems are. You're really awake. So the cultivation of mindfulness, people again make the mistake that they use willpower to try to be mindful, as if they force themselves to be awake and alert. I love telling the story of this famous monastery in Laos, just before Laos fell to the communists. I was up there in northeast Thailand. We heard tales about this monastery. There the abbot, the teacher, would take all the young monks on a long walk through the jungle. And if you've ever been to Laos, that is really mountainous. Up and down, down and up these mountain paths through the jungle all day until they were totally exhausted and dirty. And just before it got dark, he'd always managed to arrive in this clearing close to the monastery with these gigantic, beautiful trees, you know, hundreds of years old. And months before had built these platforms high up in the branches of the trees, with a platform just the size of these meditation cushions, but no railings on the outside, and a bamboo ladder to climb up. And he would send these tired, exhausted, sweaty, dirty monks up onto those platforms, you know, one to each platform. Then the abbot would take the ladder away and said, "I'll come back tomorrow morning." And there, these monks, tired, exhausted, dirty, had to sit all night, 100, 200 feet up in the trees on tiny platforms. And if they got tired, if they nodded and fell off, that was it. It would be to their death. Even if they survived the fall, the tigers and other jungle animals would eat them at night time. So, it was said that many monks got great meditation up on those platforms at night time. They really developed mindfulness. At least those who survived said that. Those who didn't survive said nothing. So as a result of that, at least you could see they tried to use force to develop mindfulness. And sure, you can use force to develop mindfulness. In those old Zen monasteries, because I went to a Zen monastery when I was a young man in north of England, simply because any place to meditate I would go to, you just couldn't choose. So I went there, and of course you got up early in the morning, and just like maybe you guys, you get up early in the morning and you're half asleep, especially when it was freezing cold in the north of England. And then the teacher would come up with the Zen stick. And I wasn't afraid, you know, I was just happily meditating, until the guy next to me got hit. Because the guy next to me was more sleepy than I was. And always remember, don't be the most sleepy. Don't be the most smart. Be somewhere in the middle, and you're always safe. That's the benefit of the middle way. So the guy sitting next to me, he was really sleepy, and he got whacked with this stick. And people said it didn't hurt, but I didn't believe it once I heard the sound. But it's amazing the result it had. After I heard that sound, I was perfectly awake. My body was straight, and my mindfulness was sharp, out of fear. But that's not how to be mindful out of fear. Of course, some people try and do that. Sit out sort of on a ledge. Go and sit in the tiger cave, or go out into the forest where there's ghosts and stuff. And people say, wow, I was really aware, really mindful. But that's not real mindfulness, that's just fear. So instead of trying to develop mindfulness through willpower or through fear, no fear of the teacher scolding you or hitting you, we don't do that in Buddhism. Instead, again, we use wisdom power to develop mindfulness. And the way to develop mindfulness using wisdom power is understanding one of the key teachings of meditation. And it's understanding the two halves to the human mind. The two halves of the human mind are the active, doing mind, and the passive, knowing mind. Now that's just one way that you can understand and regard the human mind, splitting up into these two parts. The doing mind is what chooses to lift up your sleeve of your shirt. It's what decides to scratch, what decides to move your head, what decides to have the cornflakes instead of the muesli, the one which plans what you're going to do, the one which moves, which takes notes. All that active part of the mind is called the doing mind. And the other half of the mind is just the passive knowing mind, that which sees, hears, smells, tastes, touches, that which knows what's going on. Totally passive, non-reactive, it just absorbs information. That's the passive mind. The active mind, the doing mind, is the one you probably know more than anything else, because that takes much or most of your mental energy. As human beings in today's world, we are doers, we are planners, we are thinkers, we are analyzers, we are choosers, and we analyze the choice, what we're going to do, for hours and hours and hours before we actually commit to a choice. We are so active in doing things. We're very good at doing things. We can construct cities, we can invent new things, we can plan our lives and have really successful lives. We can even build retreat centers. That's doing. Now that takes up a lot of energy. And the way your human mind works is that the active mind, the doing, the planner, the thinker, that has first choice of the energy. And anything left, the remnants, the leftovers, are what is available for the knowing mind. Which is one of the reasons why people are half asleep. They just haven't got enough energy left just to taste their food, just to see the sunsets, just to know the feeling of the wind on their face. They're too busy doing things. They've got nothing left just to know. In this retreat, you do very little. You don't even have to worry about getting up at a certain time in the morning. You don't have to be concerned about being told off by Ajahn Brahm, even though many of you deserve being told off. I will not do that. You don't have to worry at all. You don't have to worry about getting the food. It all just comes into the place. You don't have to worry about anything. This means that you have nothing to do on this retreat. Of course, you'll always find something to do. You'll find some reason to use your mobile phone and call your family, or check up the stock market, or check up the cricket, or whatever else you're addicted to. You'll always want to sort of take notes, or write your biography, or figure out the meaning of life. We always do lots and lots of things, but it's limited here. There's very little you can actually do. And because of that, it means that deliberately I'm starving your doer of energy. There's nothing you can do here. You can try and make stuff for yourself, it's very difficult. Which means when you do nothing, all that energy which is wasted, thinking, planning, criticizing, deciding what to do, thinking about all sorts of philosophies, all of that active part of the mind is subdued, so the energy is now released, it's free to go into the knowing mind. Literally means you start to wake up. you become more aware. The food starts to taste more delicious. You start to appreciate the Milky Way at night. It's always been there. But now you've got space in your mind to be mindful, to be aware of it, to appreciate it. And even the feelings in your body become much more aware of how your body feels. And you do start to notice the feeling of the warm, hot sun on your skin. You're waking up. You're becoming aware. Simply because now you have energy to be aware. One of the problems of our modern life is we run around so much, we have to, we've got hardly any choice. We have so many responsibilities and duties that our knower gets hardly any energy left at all. It's tired. And chronic tiredness of mindfulness is called depression. You know, we're so tired, and our mindfulness gets so little energy that whatever we taste has just got no flavour on it. Even what we see is like pastel colours, even bright colours, what is for other people bright and brilliant, it's just like all washed out. The gorgeous sunsets, as if like, you know, it's been all soaked and most of the colour has drained away. And even whatever you feel, it's got no spice to it, no piquancy to it, it's just all dull. That is a sign of depression, that nothing excites you. Everything is dull, and the reason is because your knower, your mindfulness, has really, really low energy. This is one of the reasons why meditation is a great antidote to depression. As long as the meditation which does a lot of letting things go, leaving things alone, stop fighting, stop doing, stop challenging, just let things be and allow energy to go into knowing. Instead of wasting it, fighting. And as the energy goes into knowing, you literally do wake up. For those of you who still have problem with sleepiness, you know, when you're meditating dullness, please don't fight the dullness. Because if you're fighting dullness, you are just wasting more energy in the controlling, the fighting, in the doing. When really, if you know what dullness is, it means low mental energy, low awareness. What you really need to do is leave things alone. Stop doing things. Stop reacting. Stop trying to control things. Stop complaining. Just stop, for goodness sake. Let things be. And then the natural energy of your mind will start to go into the mindfulness. You start to wake up. And the dullness vanishes. It disappears. For many years, when I was a young monk in Thailand, I was always struggling with dullness. It was always a fight. In the early mornings, we'd get up at 3 o'clock, and it was very difficult to keep awake at that time. And you'd always struggling, and I did have strong willpower. If I wanted to, I could really force myself. And a lot of times, you'd force yourself, and you'd break through the dullness. But as soon as you broke through that dullness, you couldn't stop thinking. It was restlessness. So you calm down the restlessness, calm down, and then you fall asleep again. And for me, there was always this extremes of dullness or sleepiness, and I could never find a place in between. Until afterwards, when I stopped, I didn't use any more willpower. I thought, what is going on? Let's try and understand this. And the key to understanding it was realizing that every time I was fighting, I was consuming energy. Energy which really should have been left free to go into just bare mindfulness. So after a long time I realized fighting is not the way to overcome dullness. You can't will mindfulness to increase. You just stop doing things. So I just allowed my sleepiness to be. There's nothing wrong with being sleepy. It's not breaking any precepts. It's just being sleepy, that's all. And you can't do much harm when you're fast asleep. So I allowed myself to be sleepy and just made peace with it. Did an amazing thing called being compassionate to my sleepiness. Never mind, it's all right to be sleepy. I open the door of my heart to sleepiness. Remember, real compassion is unconditioned. It's not just being compassionate to things you like. even compassionate to things which are unpleasant or embarrassing. Okay, I'm going to be kind to my sleepiness. Come on, sleepiness, you can stay. You can be as long as you want. And because I wasn't fighting, I was making peace with it, I was being kind to it, what was happening underneath was the energy, the little energy which I had in my mind, was not being wasted in this battle with sleepiness. And instead it was freed to go into mindfulness. And little by little, you tend to wake up. The body will straighten up. And when the sleepiness did lift, it was like a mist which was lifting from the mountain in the early morning sun. When that mindfulness did lift, there was no restlessness anymore. It was just beautiful peacefulness. Because I've been making peace and being kind and being still all the time, when the dullness vanished, I was perfectly peaceful. I could go off into a nice meditation. That was the way to overcome the sleepiness and dullness. Sleepiness and dullness is just low mindfulness, that's all. And a lot of time it's just natural, as you can't avoid it, it's part of being a human being. Again, recalling those times in Thailand, my first years, when I look back upon that, I was thinking, my goodness, even if the Buddha was born in London and went to Thailand to meditate, he would also have sloth and torpor. The reason why, we try and get away with 4 hours sleep at night, going to bed at 11 o'clock, getting up at 3 o'clock. That's not enough for a human being, especially, you know, a young man, 23, 24 when I first went to Thailand. So number one, I was sleep deprived. I didn't have enough sleep. And you'd ask psychologists and doctors these days and say, that's really a big cause of, you know, depression and psychological disorder and many other physical disorders as well, you know, sleep deprived. That's what they do in Guantanamo Bay to torture people. So really, if I'd have known that at the time, I'd have sued my teacher, got a big payout for abuse. But no. So 4 hours sleep, didn't have enough sleep. Number two, you were in a climate you were just totally unused to. This was the tropics. Thick jungle, hardly any wind getting through the jungle. It was hot, it was steamy. No air conditioners or fan. There wasn't even any electricity in that place. So it was a very tough climate to be in. And lastly, you were malnourished. In those days, it was rice, sticky rice, which the soil was so bad in the northeast of Thailand that even the rice hardly had any sort of goodness in it. It was very, very bad rice. And whatever slithered on the ground, that's what we had to eat. I would have loved to be a vegetarian in those days, but there weren't any vegetables, literally. It was rice and rotten fish, and it really was rotten fish. To tell you what it meant, rotten fish, which was a staple part of the diet, during the rains, when the paddy fields were all flooded, they would collect these small fish, and they put them in an earthen jar, just bung them in, no salt, no preservative, and just an old piece of plastic on top, and just let them ferment. And they stank. It really is just a terrible smell. And one day I was cleaning up by the monastery kitchen and I found one of the jars with the rotten fish in it. This is absolutely a true story. And the plastic had been perforated, allowing the flies to come in, lay their eggs, so the whole thing was crawling with maggots. Seeing that, I went to throw it away. But visiting at that time was the head man of the village. Now the head man was the most highly educated, the most refined of all of these farmers. And even he looked at me and said, what are you doing? I said, look, it's gone off, this cord with maggots, I've got to throw it away. And he grabbed it and said, no, that means extra protein. And that's what we had tomorrow for lunch. That was really gross stuff we got to. And it wouldn't matter, I don't mind if it was gross tasting, but it just had no nutriment in it. So I was malnourished. I was really thin in those days. I'm just making up for it now. It's fair enough, okay. If you'd have seen me in those days, you'd think, okay, you know, you deserve to, you know, to balance, you know, your early thin life. So you were malnourished. You were so sleep deprived. Climate was really weird. You're not used to it. And anyone would fall asleep in that sort of situation. It's just, you're not used to it. You know what? One day, for a few days, I went to do my visa down in Bangkok. And down in Bangkok, you got decent food. I mean, actually, food you could eat. And it actually had some protein in it. And number two, you know, we could have a nice rest. And we had found this air-conditioned room. And it's in Bangkok, in this really luxurious temple. We had an air-conditioned room. So we got permission to use it at 3 o'clock in the morning. And you know, none of us were sleepy in the air-conditioned room. Just making it climate comfortable was all we needed. And we had no spot on top at all. It was brilliant. And I realized it was just the climate was making you tired. And it was just cause and effect. It was nature, that's all. So in experiences like that, I mean, don't be upset if you feel tired. It's a physical cause. You didn't sleep well last night. Or, you know, you're going through some physical stuff. Or, you know, you're just basically exhausted and it takes a while for you to get your energy back after living such a busy life. And some of you come from Europe and the United States. You're going to have jet lag. Of course you're going to be tired. So don't fight it. Love it. Make peace with it. Be kind with it. And then you'll find the little energy you do have can go into mindfulness. And not just through sloth and toil, but even if you feel quite ordinary, don't do so much. Let the energy flow even more into mindfulness. So the mindfulness gets stronger and stronger and stronger. You will find the less you do, the more still you maintain your mind, the more powerful your mindfulness becomes. Stillness is the cause for strong mindfulness. Not willpower, not forcing yourself, not punishing yourself. I've got to be mindful, I've got to be mindful, I've got to be mindful. No. Just be still and mindfulness increases naturally. You may not notice that on this retreat because your mindfulness increases incrementally, not just big bursts of increase, and you just get used to it. But you'll find that when you leave this retreat, you'll be amazed at how awake you feel and how you see things which you never noticed before, simply because your eyes have opened. Your mind is more sensitive. You become mindful. Now another sign of strong mindfulness is happiness. It was an interesting discovery to see the more mindful you are, the more happy you are. It is just a natural connection. The mindfulness is energy of the mind, as is this happiness which I'm telling you to go and indulge in. The more mindful you are, the happier you are. The more dull you are, the more grumpy you are. You know that. When you're really dull, you haven't slept well at night. Then you go up to poor Daniel. Where's the food? Bianca. We just got this rubbish again to eat today. What you mean is no water again? You know what it's like when you're really dull and nothing is nice and you're really grumpy. But when you've got full mindfulness, everything is so still and peaceful, so much energy in the mind. Yeah, electricity is off today, woohoo! Strong mindfulness is strong happiness. Now, you mentioned this because a few people have asked in the question, how can you develop like this beautiful, delightful breath? I get the breath, it's just the breath. How on earth can a breath become delightful? It's a breath, for goodness sake. Yeah, a sunset can be beautiful. Yeah, Angelina Jolie can be beautiful. But the breath is so boring. It's just a breath. Just breath, millions of breaths. How can a breath be delightful? You wait until you get mindful. Because when the mindfulness starts to increase, not only do you see much more, what you see becomes richer. It becomes more beautiful. You taste more. And you get these incredible experiences on a meditation retreat. You really get very still, so the mindfulness builds up. It's the opposite of being grumpy. It's being, you know, energized. And you open your eyes and you see, my God, look at that floor. Have you actually seen the patterns in this bamboo? And how beautiful it is? It's not just brown. It's got hundreds of different shades of brown. And just the way it is, this is natural bamboo. And the way it is, you can see the knots and the little striations in the different colors. And you can look at that and say, wow, look at that. You've been walking on it all week, you never noticed it. But you look at it now with mindfulness, wow, that's incredible. You are not going crazy. No one put drugs in the breakfast. This is just the nature of a mind which gets energized. You start to see beauty in the most unlikely of places. I have many stories. One of those stories, one of the first time was in Thailand, on this old concrete floor of Wat Nanacha. It's been covered up now with plastic or whatever. But it had an old concrete floor, and you were doing walking meditation, backwards and forwards, walking, 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 watching your feet. And then suddenly, without any warning, I had to stop because I was looking at the concrete in front of me. When you do walking meditation, put your gaze about 2 meters in front of you. I never noticed, I mentioned that before. Gaze 2 meters in front of you, so you know you're not going to bang into the wall, you're not going to trip over anything. It just gives you a sense of safety if you look 2 meters in front. Looking 2 meters in front, wow, look at that concrete. And as soon as you started to look at it, the whole thing like expanded and it just revealed incredible beauty. There were just so many different shades of grey in there and just the texture of it. Given it was laid by the villagers, not like by professional grano workers, so it was all uneven. But that gave it like a texture. It was like a mountainscape. And you could see so many different shades of grey, and the way the whole thing was just arranged together, it was a work of art. And I just stood there for about half an hour looking at this piece of concrete and thinking I should cut it out and send it to some gallery somewhere because it was absolutely beautiful. And of course, at the time, you don't know what's going on, you're just enjoying yourself. And then after half an hour, it just disappeared. It went back to ordinary, boring concrete again. And that was what was happening. My mindfulness had got very strong. So even in an ordinary piece of concrete, I could see these beautiful, beautiful shapes. But the best story happened here a few years ago. And I know I say this every retreat, but it's such a wonderful story. It was a time when, after a very nice meditation, I went to the toilet. You know what's coming next. This is a golden oldie. And after going to the toilet, I just happened, just by chance, to look at the content of the bowl. And if you think a lump of concrete looks beautiful, wow! Look at that! The different shades of brown. I mean, it's not just brown. There's hundreds of different shades, and they're really rich. They're really deep browns. The sort of browns which, you know, an artist will have a hard time actually to colour in. And have you ever noticed with a lump of shit, it's always got a tiny bit of mucus on the outside, which means that the water goes on and like glistens like a diamond. And you have all this beautiful sparkly stuff. And I haven't even gone in yet to the fragrance. The fragrance, oh, that was deep. Man, it was like rich, it was like full. And you could actually smell the whole lot. And I was looking at that toilet bowl. I don't know, 5 or 10 minutes. They must have thought I had something wrong with my digestive tract or whatever. I was in there for so long. And I don't know if they heard me say, wow, look at that. That's amazing. Oh. But, you know, it was only about 5 or 10 minutes because, you know, I am a monk and I have trained in letting go. If I had done that training, I'd probably have taken it out and put it on my wall to admire for the rest of my life. But no, it was a tough thing to do. You know what it's like to really let go of something which is beautiful. You had to. I can't do it. I have to. No, I can't. Okay. I pushed the button. And it disappeared. Oh, that was such a great act of letting go. Talk about renouncing things. Monks really know how to renounce what's beautiful. Okay, that's. I usually overdo that story, but that's pretty much what happened. And that's what will happen to you, too. Now you can imagine, if you can see, this is, I don't make these stories, well some of them I make up, but this one I don't, this one I don't make up, I made up the one the other night about the coffee and the medicine. But this is a true story, happened here in the toilets, and it just shows you what mindfulness can do. Imagine it can see such beauty in an old turd. Imagine what you can see, you know, in your breath. Incredible beauty. Just one breath. Oh, this is absolutely delightful. Just one step when you're on the walking path. Wow, this is great. This is where you really start to develop the happy meditations, the bliss of meditation. It is just a function of your increased mindfulness. You're becoming awake and aware. And my goodness, it's fun. Incredible fun. Not only what you can see much more of it. Things which were hidden before because you were just too dull. But what you see is always incredibly beautiful and lovely and delightful. It's something which I never expected before, to see how beautiful the world can be. Just when you are aware and fully awake. And even stuff which is not supposed to be beautiful becomes beautiful. You understand just with beauty and negativity how much it is you add on to the world. Even pain, disappointment, frustration, how much we add on is huge. Because when you have incredibly strong mindfulness, you can only add on happiness and joy, appreciation, gratitude, all these positive emotions. So as you become more mindful, you become happier and more percipient. And that means it becomes incredibly easy to meditate. You're just sitting here and your body is actually a delightful body. When you relax it, you know what it's like sometimes. You wake up in the morning, it may be a holiday, and you're really cozy in bed. You don't have to get up to go to the toilet. You know, you've got no business to be done. You're just cozy. Just, this is really nice. I just want to stay in here a bit longer. You have a delight in the body. And it's the same when you're sitting in meditation. You get your body nice and comfortable and it feels so delightful. The cozy meditation position. I'm used to this position now, so just even right now I can feel the joy, the pleasure of a body which is relaxed at ease. The same sort of coziness when you first wake up in the morning. I'm mindful of that delight, because it's important to develop the mindfulness of delight. And then I can let the body disappear and I'm watching this present moment. It's not just an ordinary present moment, it's not dull at all, it's beautiful. The fact that I can just be in this moment. And I've got no one asking me to sort of solve their problem in this monastery over the world, or solve some other problem. I was messing around with the emails this morning. I am like a monastery consultant now. Things go wrong in a monastery and I'm supposed to be the one who fixes it up. And so you get all these problems people load onto me, and I've got my own monastery to fix up. Now you sort out your own monasteries, but I'm just too soft and too kind. So you attend all this work, and then when I can meditate, no monasteries to fix up, no monks and no nuns messing around, no lay people asking me to go here and go there, no people just asking me, you know, what really is jhana and what is the nature of enlightenment. I can just be free at last. No one asking me about what should I do with my husband, what should I do with my kids. You know, I became a monk to get rid of all of that. You know, I didn't get married, I didn't have kids, I thought I would have no kid problem, no wife problems. But I have more wife problems than anyone who's married. So I have all your wife problems, and all your kid problems. Well, I don't mind. But when you're meditating, at last I can just disappear. I've escaped. I've escaped into the present moment. In the present moment there's nothing to be done. There's nothing which has gone wrong. The present moment is the most perfect moment in the whole world. It's perfect because it's already here. You can't do anything with it. It's just here, that's all. It's arrived. Have you ever read those magazines on the aircraft and about these famous people who've arrived? Who was it? Who's that guy who was playing James Bond? Daniel Craig. He's now arrived as a film star, or some other rock singer, they've arrived. And when I heard this word, now to arrive is actually, yes, at last you've arrived. And I like that word because every time I'm in the present moment, yes, I'm arrived. I'm here. I've arrived. Brilliant. And you feel so good that you've arrived. Because I've spent so much time trying to get here, like you did. Travelling halfway around the world, and now you're here. You've arrived. For goodness sake, be here. Now you've arrived, and stop going somewhere else. So at last I'm arrived. In the present moment, I've arrived. I can put down my bags, put away my passport. I'm arrived, I'm here, and I can just be. So just being is just beautiful. I really appreciate not having to do anything. I don't know if, you know, you do too much, I do too much. But at least when I'm meditating, right, that's it, I'm out of here, I'm not going to do anything at all. This is total irresponsibility. All responsibility is about the past or the future. You know, you're responsible for, you know, what you did in the past. Yeah, fair enough. I'm responsible for all the things I'm supposed to do later on today, tomorrow. You know, as an Abba and spiritual dictator. I'm not the spiritual director of the Buddha Society, I'm the spiritual dictator. All that sort of stuff, you know, I'll leave that till later on. But right now, you're totally free, nothing to do in the whole world. When I was young, I used to have these fantasies about monks and hermits, you know, like living off into these mountains, having nothing to do at all. I remember the story of, it's a Chinese story of these two hermits living up in the mountains in somewhere in remote part of China. Just living so simply, so wise, not a worry in the world. Just, you know, eating your lunch and the rest of the day meditating and just watching the rain fall and the streams form and just the water just run over the rocks down to wherever it went to. Just watching the clouds go past the mountain. No worries, no concerns in the world. And there was the monk who lived on the top of the mountain and the one who lived halfway down. And the emperor was having so much trouble with his ministers, with his government. You know what governments are like? Haven't changed. Any place in the world, they're always incompetent. And it's true. And so the emperor was just really getting a headache, trying to find some suitable people to run the empire. And he thought, the two hermits. They're wise, they're compassionate, they're totally incorruptible because they don't want anything. So he went there with a couple of generals to invite the hermits to run the Chinese Empire. And he went to the one at the top and said, no, you are incorruptible because you don't want anything for yourself. You're so wise and compassionate. Can you please help me run China? And then the monk never answered. He just went to the stream and splashed some water in his ears and washed his ears out. He said, I'm sorry, I just got a bit of filth in my ears. And the emperor was smart enough to know what he meant. So he left and he went down to see the second hermit halfway down the mountain. And he was about to ask the second hermit the same question. Can you please come and help run the empire? I need someone who's wise, compassionate and incorruptible. And before he even said that, the top monk's attendant came running down and said, I've got a message from the top monk. He said, don't drink the water, there's some filth in it. And the emperor realized, there's no way I'm going to get these guys to run an empire. So he left them by themselves. And I always remember that story. Just simple people, not doing anything, just living as hermits, peace, no problems at all. And that was like the fantasy I had of being a monk. Just, you know, going to Thailand or to Australia, living in a little hut or a cave, just meditating all day and just no one bothering you at all. Oh God, it hasn't worked out like that at all. And it never does, but I can always become a hermit again. And my hermitage is not my cave. My hermitage is when I close my eyes and come into the present moment. Now I'm a hermit again. Secluded from the future and the past where all the business lies. I can be peaceful there. That's my hermitage. That's my escape. That's where I go to get away from the whole world. Not Jhana Grove, because there's still things to be done in Jhana Grove. But in the present moment, deep inside, that's where you find your hermitage. And that's where mindfulness starts to grow. When you're doing something, it's all doing something for the future. It's always doing something about the past. That's where all the work lies. So if you can just become more habituated to the present moment, to the real hermitage, then you'll find your mindfulness increases. You become more awake, more alert, more wise, and more energized, more happy. And for those of you who are getting a bit frustrated or depressed, come into the present moment. Don't fight the depression. Don't fight the frustration. If you get frustrated and think, I don't want frustration, I'm going to really meditate now. Well, you're asking for more problems. Just embrace your frustration. Frustration, give me more. Depression, please, let's see how depressed I can become. See if I can beat the Guinness Book of Records Depression and Frustration Index. See if I can be the most... When you accept things, it means you're not doing anything. It means you're leaving things alone. You're becoming still. And you're giving energy a chance to go into the mindfulness. And it goes into the mindfulness, you become more alert, more awake, more energized, more happy. You feel so much better. And that is the increase of mindfulness. Once that mindfulness has increased, yeah, you do see the contents of your toilet bowl is beautiful. You do see your breath is delightful. You do see the walking is incredibly amazing. Why can I see this before? It's incredible what's going on in just one step. You go outside, you just look at a blade of grass. Wow! Look at what's happening there. And you understand some of these great poems, like One Which Comes to Mind is by William Blake. Very famous four lines. To see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, an eternity in an hour. To see a world in a grain of sand, how can you do that? It's mindfulness. Mindfulness has got so strong, if you pick up a grain of sand or a grain of dirt, there's a whole world in there. It's amazing what goes on in there. See a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wild flower. If you think a piece of shit is beautiful, you take up a wild flower. Wow, that's heaven. So much beauty in there. And wild flowers are tiny little things. But when you have the strong mindfulness because you've developed a lot of stillness and peace, a flower just blows you away. You're enjoying the happiness of meditation now. Well done. And now he goes into these beautiful things. Hold infinity in the palm of your hand. What a beautiful saying. The infinite. whatever you want to think is the meaning of life, God, infinite meaning of, it's there right in the palm of your hand, you have it. It's not apart from you, it's not held by some priest or some book, it's right there in the palm of your hand. Eternity in an hour, it's only because an hour rhymed with flower. It really means eternity in a moment. Just this present moment is timeless. And those of you who are time constrained, who always haven't got enough time, you come into this present moment and at last you're free. So you have all the time in the world. You're just sitting here and time has no more meaning for you. Half an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, you just don't notice any time pass at all. Every moment is having fun. But time has no more meaning. You've touched eternity, the timeless present moment. What a beautiful thing that is. To see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour, by William Blake. It was about 17th century or something. But it's a good description of what mindfulness is. And then with such a mindfulness, it's so easy to meditate, as you can expect. You have happy meditation, you're enjoying yourself. And everything you do. And when you actually get into meditation, watching the breath or watching the feelings in the feet, because it's a very simple technique, because you're not doing very much at all in the meditation, that mindfulness gets even stronger. Because you've got heaps of energy in mindfulness already, it's very strong. But because you do even less, the energy increases and increases and increases. And that's where you get these beautiful lights from, the nimittas. They're powerful. And again, one of the problems people keep on saying in meditation, yeah, they get the breath and it disappears, but it's dark, nothing's happening there, they don't see the nimitta. Two reasons. You know, the first reason is you haven't got enough energy, enough sort of joy, so the breath isn't delightful enough when it disappears, there's no joy really left to fire up a nimitta. But the main reason is because, again, you've been doing too much, so mindfulness isn't strong enough yet. In that darkness, you know, your eyes aren't sharp enough to see what's going on in there. So with more stillness, mindfulness increases and you never have that problem. The breath, before it disappears, is so gorgeous, so beautiful. When it does disappear, this beautiful nimittas come up. It's beauty, delight all the way. The piti sukha starts at a particular part of meditation. Piti sukha is a Buddhist word for this joy and happiness. It starts at a certain place and it just carries on. It gets more and more and more. And that really gets you into some powerful meditations. It's why in mindfulness I coin the terms power mindfulness, superpower mindfulness. So it's not just being mindful, it's just the intensity of that mindfulness. And it, you know it by just how beautiful things appear, how tasty is the food, how much happiness is in the body and in the meditation. That is a sign your mindfulness is getting strong. And how does that occur? Stop doing so much. Be still. Calm the thinking down. You've thought too much in your life already. So stop thinking. And please stop working out the Dhamma about the meaning of things. We can spend so much time philosophizing and thinking, but when the mind becomes still, then we can actually see things. You know, one of the things which I learned as a physicist at Cambridge is how thinking just can't get you anywhere. Because all these great insights of quantum physics, they were just totally illogical, but they are true. You can't think your way through these amazing, stupid-like sayings of quantum physics. But that is the reality of things. One thing I learned from studying theoretical physics was the limitations of thought. Basically, we don't have enough data to start with. We think from only limited knowledge of the world. That's why we don't get anywhere. We just get into arguments. So So instead, suspend all your thinking and philosophizing. Be still. Get lots and lots of mindfulness up. And then when the mindfulness is very, very strong, then you can start to see things. And you can base some of your philosophies on the data, the experiences you get from deep meditation. They will change the way you understand life. Because the fundamental starting point of your thought thinking has been changed. You've got real data rather than false assumptions. So stop thinking. Even the Buddha said this. It's one of the famous suttas. It's only a small sutta. I think it's in the Anguttara somewhere. He said these are the lingering obstacles to the deep meditation. You get so deep, you're very peaceful, and you waste that peace by philosophizing. Because you know what it's like sometimes in the deep meditation, your mind is so clear, it's so strong, at last actually you can actually think clearly. And you can give yourself amazing teachings on Dhamma just at that very end. But you're wasting the time. You should don't do that. The Buddha actually called it as the lingering hindrance of Dhamma Vitakka, thinking about the Dhamma. Just get that extra experience of jhana first, and then you can got something to build your thinking on. You got some experience, but don't go philosophizing, because you're wasting that energy which you built up through stillness. Shh. Be still, as still as you possibly can. The energy builds, mindfulness increases. And you have a wonderful time. So if you're not happy yet, if you haven't got this strong mindfulness yet, it means you are doing too much. Rest, relax, stop thinking, stop planning, be in the moment, let go, be kind. All these amazing words which means do nothing. And mindfulness increases. And you understand the way of meditation. So that's the talk this morning. Woohoo! Easy and powerful. And you have lots and lots of fun. So, any questions about this morning's talk? You've got 5 minutes. Going, gone. Okay? And thank you to the electricity company for keeping going until the end of the talk. And thank you. Anyone who's really, really fed up, you can go and meditate with a dog. Like this. I do loving kindness meditation. This is free for anybody to cuddle during their meditation. But don't take it out of the hall. So only in this hall you can cuddle. And give yourself some loving kindness. Okay, very good.